The following is for your ears only. I'm David Halpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson, and we have newsmakers, experts, and reporters to bring you these stories.
Shutdown politics, behind the backstage bargaining, and how the outcome may affect Democrats, Republicans, Tea Partiers, and the next elections.
The bigger budget battle over even more massive cutting proposed by GOP Congressman Paul Ryan for 2012 and beyond.
Outrage in Afghanistan, confusion in Libya, the violence sparked by a Koran burning and the NATO bombing of rebel tanks.
Legacy of an epidemic, how a controversial war against small Pox changed U.S. government healthcare and the lessons for today.
Going for Baroque, Japanese-born jazz pianist Junko Onishi on her new CD of that name.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only, a production of Gatewave Incorporated, the nonprofit volunteer 24/7 radio reading service that brings vital information and enrichment to those with disabilities. For your ears only, for the week of April 10th, I'm David Halpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson.
It would be inexcusable, given the relatively narrow differences when it comes to numbers between the two parties, that we can't get this done.
We can't impose our will on the Senate. All we can do is to fight for all of the spending cuts that we can get an agreement to.
It's an ideological battle. It has nothing to do with the fiscal integrity of this country. It has everything to do with the ideology on that other side of the Capitol.
It may or may not be darkest before the dawn, but in Washington, it can be testiest before the deal and more revealing. President Obama hinted at the closeness over numbers as budget talks for the rest of fiscal 2011 went down to the wire. And though House Speaker John Boehner insisted it was all about cuts, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid pulled the curtain aside to reveal long simmering social and policy differences that had to be compromised in a final deal to keep the government open. In addition to another $38 billion in painful cuts, there had to be promises of separate Senate votes and likely defeats on conservative riders to restrain the Environmental Protection Agency and defund women's health provider Planned Parenthood, whose abortion services are already blocked from federal funding.
To consider the implications of last week's dramatic deal on the shape of government and politics as we approach another congressional and presidential election cycle, for your ears only, we're joined again by political consultant Craig Shirley of Shirley and Bannister Public Affairs in Washington, also author of Rendezvous with Destiny, Ronald Reagan and the Campaign That Changed America. Welcome back to our program.
Thank you.
Who had the tougher job getting his own party behind the latest budget deal, Boehner or Reid?
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt about it that it was John Boehner. The Republican Party is a much more divided party now than the Democratic Party, and that's really the result of 8 years of the big government Republicanism of George Bush. So now, in essence, the Republican Party is housing two philosophies. One, if you would think of Delta House or the movie Animal House, is one part is the Republican Party's Delta House, the other is the Omega House, and they're at war with each other.
What's your view on which party actually would have suffered more if the government had shut down?
That's an interesting question, because the Democratic Party tends, I think everybody would agree, tends to be the party of government, whereas the Republican Party tends to be the party against government, although, as addressed earlier, that's less defined now than it was when Ronald Reagan was president. I think that in a sense, the Democratic Party may have been hurt simply because they have a bigger stake in the governmental system and in government programs, and that their base constituency might have been more angry with them for not keeping government open and functioning than, say, the Republican constituency that would have been angry with them.
But might not independents have seen Republicans, because of their anti-government philosophy, as sort of more pleased and provocative of a government shutdown?
I don't know, David. I know that there were 800,000 people who were classified as non-essential, which is a wonderful existential question. You get up in the morning and you ask yourself whether or not you're essential or not. It would have been an interesting, just in a laboratory sense, to see how the government would have operated or how people's lives would have gone on without 800,000 federal bureaucrats going to work every day. I know that 93% of the Department of Education was classified as non-essential, but essential functions would have continued had there been a shutdown. The Food Inspection Service at agriculture would have continued. The Mint would have continued printing money. Security would have continued in the country. So it would have been interesting to see how Americans would react to a government with 800,000 less employees.
Should we be surprised that social issues like abortion and Planned Parenthood return to the spotlight after hearing that the newly empowered House Tea Party faction was focused laser-like on spending?
Well, that is going to be the fly in the buttermilk. Boehner apparently bailed at the last minute on the funding of Planned Parenthood and kicked it over to the Senate, where I think everybody realizes, because of Democrats still can have control there, hold sway, that the funding will continue for Planned Parenthood. And that's really, I think you'll see in the next couple of days, a lot of the social right groups really speaking out against the House leadership for bailing on this issue.
And how important will those compromises be for Tea Party freshmen when they go back to constituents for whom deal is really a four-letter word?
Yeah, deal really is a four-letter word. And compromise is a multiplier of that. The Tea Party, and which makes up most of the Republican Party today, is in no mood whatsoever to hear about deals or compromises or anything else like that. And they're going to have to figure out how to sell this. Now, you could say that on one hand, it's the most significant cut in a generation. $78 billion is what Boehner was saying last night. On the other hand, out of a budget of $1.3 trillion, it's not even a drop in the bucket. It's a drop of a drop of in the bucket. And the question becomes is that how are they going to react to the tougher fights down the road?
On the other hand, the Tea Party's image has weakened as its avatars actually engaged in the political process. A new Pew poll shows a 15-point increase in public disagreement with the Tea Party, 13 points among independents, and even 11 points among moderate to liberal Republicans. Yeah, a bad trend?
That's to be expected as the Tea Party becomes more focused and more defined. It's going to pick up more passionate supporters, but also, by like token, more passionate opponents. That really doesn't surprise me. It couldn't continue an upward arc forever.
How does the deal on final 2011 spending affect the bigger debate on a budget for 2012 and beyond, beginning with the very transformative proposal put out last week by House Budget Chairman Paul Ryan?
Well, Ryan's proposal is very good, but what I thought was interesting, fellas, was the within 2 or 3 days, the Republican Study Committee, led by Congressman Jim Jordan of Ohio, came out with their own budget, which almost seemed to suggest that they were undercutting the offer by Paul Ryan. So there's some interesting interplay going on inside the Republican Party. What you saw last night was essentially spring training for the bigger fight that's coming up on debt limit and on other budget issues. Those are going to be, the Super Bowl and the World Series and the World Cup all rolled into one. And so that's where the real fight is going to be over future spending plans by this government.
How do you think this deal affects the position of President Obama, who hung back until the very end and then basked a bit in the glow of success?
Nudges him toward the middle, which is where he wants to be going into 2012. He signed the he said he wasn't going to sign the tax cut, and then he didn't December. He said he wasn't going to go for any spending cuts. Now he's agreed to spending cuts. So he needs to he needs to shore up. I mean, his standing is still strong among various constituencies, minorities. Where he's lost steam is among the independents, and he needs to gain them back. And the way to do that is for him to move gently to the middle.
One quick last question about the slow-to-develop Republican presidential field. What do you make of Donald Trump's number two position in a recent GOP poll with 17%? Do you take him seriously as a candidate or a TV host pumping his ratings?
Well, the question is why. This is a man who, he could jaywalk and get publicity. he doesn't need to do this for publicity, and I don't know why he's on this birther kick anyway. It's a ridiculous issue as far as I'm concerned. He's marginalizing himself, and I don't think he's laying a base for himself in the future. The question is, why is he doing it? And that means getting inside the mind of Donald Trump, and I don't think that's possible.
Craig Shirley is a Washington political consultant and author of Rendezvous with Destiny, Ronald Reagan and the Campaign That Changed America.
Next, more on the bigger budget battle ahead. For your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern with another quote from the news. The stubbornness is absurd. That was French Foreign Minister Alain Juppé on Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo's refusal to step down, even after French and NATO peacekeepers targeted air attacks on his stronghold, now surrounded by forces fighting for the man who beat him in a recent election. Now this.
Nearly $1.5 trillion in additional economic growth over the decade. This plan is estimated to result in more jobs. Nearly 1 million jobs next year to be created under this plan than otherwise would be.
This plan lays out cuts to education at a time when we are falling desperately behind commitment to our children, an historic attack on seniors' health care, and hundreds of thousands of jobs eliminated, all in the name of austerity.
With an 11th-hour agreement, almost literally, on federal spending in the final months of fiscal 2011, attention now turns to a much bigger battle over the budget for 2012 and beyond. And starting the process is the proposal put forth last week by House Budget Chairman Paul Ryan, the Wisconsin Republican. Quickly attacked by Democrats like Congressman Paul Tonko of New York, the government gospel, according to Ryan, nevertheless, sets the first parameters of debate.
To consider the content of the Ryan proposal, for your ears only, we're joined again by Mark Goldwine, Policy Director for the Bipartisan Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Welcome back to our program.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Bottom line, how does the Ryan proposal affect the nation's budget deficits and total debt compared to current spending, compared to what President Obama has suggested and to the bipartisan deficit commission that Obama appointed and mostly ignored?
Sure. Well, I think we need to give credit where credit is due. Congressman Ryan's plan is an aggressive deficit reduction plan. We've tried to run the numbers comparison, and it appears that he reduces the deficit by about the same amount as President Obama's fiscal commission. And he brings debt down to a stable level and then reduces it beyond the 10-year window. This is much more aggressive than what President Obama did in his budget, and it's much more aggressive than where we're going under current law, which is, frankly, unsustainable.
Let's look at how Ryan deals with some sacred cows that were way off the table in last week's bickering over final spending in 2011, beginning with defense. Is that pretty much what Obama had outlined?
Yeah, well, you know what? There's a growing divide in the Republican Party between those who are really the hardcore spending cutters and want to look for a lot of waste in the defense budget, and those who still see defense as kind of a sacred cow. And so I think this Ryan budget kind of took the middle ground, which is we're going to accept the savings that Secretary Gates has outlined and President Obama has agreed to, but we're not going to go any further, which basically means defense spending is going to continue to grow at about the rate of inflation as it's scheduled to.
Does he specify other security-related spending, Homeland Security and Veterans Affairs, for those people who've already made a sacrifice for security?
Again, in this area, he takes the same approach the Obama administration does, which is these programs actually will grow faster than inflation, but maybe not quite as fast as some would have liked them to. But there's not really very many serious cuts, either from Congressman Ryan or from President Obama, that go after the security portion of the budget.
Let's consider Ryan's major restructuring of health-related spending, starting with Medicare. His proposal for replacing it with vouchers and the projected savings?
Well, so essentially what Congressman Ryan does is he says starting in 2022, instead of the government paying for your health services, the government is going to subsidize you to buy private insurance from a bunch of competing private insurers. And that's going to save money in two ways. There's the indirect savings, which are when private sector companies compete and you're looking for the lowest price one, that may put some downward pressure on total healthcare prices in a variety of ways. There's probably a little bit of savings there. The larger savings is just the fact that Congressman Ryan calls for the subsidy to grow more slowly than basically we'd be projected to under current law. And that means that over time people's premiums are going to increase.
So
a large portion of the savings is going to come from people paying more for their health care.
So that's a saving for Americans as taxpayers, but an increased spending on their part as consumers of health care.
That's right. And the question is, you know, the hope of those on the right is that the bulk of it will come from efficiencies and slower healthcare cost growth, et cetera. But I'm less optimistic. I think there will be some of that, but a lot of it is just going to be people paying more for their healthcare.
any way to project costs to local and state treasuries if folks with reduced Medicare or Medicaid support end up flooding local emergency rooms?
I don't think there has been good projections on that. But you bring up another piece of what Congressman Ryan proposes, which is block granting Medicaid and then having the states have more responsibility over their own Medicaid spending. And again, there's a structural component to this, which I think could have some positive effects on healthcare cost growth, which is that if states are not given a subsidy on each new marginal dollar of spending, they're going to spend their money more efficiently. But Congressman Ryan, again, has the block grants growing way slower than what's currently projected. And as a result, that's going to mean states are going to have to pay more over time. And it's going to be a tough question of where that money comes from.
Like Obama, Ryan doesn't say much about how he would pay for continued doc fixes to avoid cuts in Medicare physician fees.
That's right. This is a big disappointment. When President Obama put out his budget, he had this huge gimmick, which we rightly criticized him for, which is that he said we're going to continue to pay physicians what we are now, which is something that costs money relative to current law, about $300 billion. And then he says, we just assume Congress is going to find a way to pay for it. And Congressman Ryan commits the same exact foul here. It's what we call magic asterisks. It's savings that are completely unidentified and unspecified.
What about changes in Social Security and with savings to the government, if not the next generation of recipients?
Congressman Ryan outlines an interesting process here. He doesn't go as far as to propose a specific plan, although he has in the past proposed them. But what he says is, any year that Social Security is insolvent, the trustees are required, and then the president is required to introduce a plan, and it has to be heard in the Congress. And I think that's a positive step forward. You know, it's better that he just proposes a plan and we hear it, but I think a process like this could be very helpful in moving Social Security reform along.
Ryan talks about tax reform, but also extending current tax cuts, so no additional revenue, which your committee does not favor.
I think it would be a mistake to go through the process of comprehensive tax reform where we go through and get rid of these $1 trillion of various tax breaks and to use all of it for rate reduction. We have a huge fiscal hole that we need to close, and, you know, the fiscal commission showed you can get rates pretty low and still substantially reduce the deficit. So, yes, we need new revenue, and the place to get it is these tax expenditures, and I think it's a failing to not use any of that money for deficit reduction.
Say more about the additional revenues and taxes and from which sources that the commission thinks is necessary to help trim deficits and build political support for cuts that do the rest.
You know, I really think we can raise most of the revenue we need without having to look at raising tax rates or new taxes. There are some arguments that an energy tax or even a value-added tax makes sense economically, but there's so much garbage in the tax code. There's so many deductions, exclusions, credits, special rates that we don't need and that distort market decisions that we could get all of the money we need from scaling back and eliminating those.
Mark Goldwine is policy director for the Bipartisan Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget.
Next, outrage in Afghanistan and Libya, for your ears only. We're back for your ears only. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. It's a little like pulling a thread out of your tie. Any breach gets bigger. That was an anonymous Western nuclear executive suggesting there may have been more core melting into the containment vessel than officially acknowledged at a damaged Japanese reactor plant. He is one of several U.S. experts who say the situation may be worse than the Japanese claim. Others are calling for more detailed reports on Japanese radioactivity drifting over the United States. Now this.
If they do not stop such kind of activities, we may not be only limited to such kind of gathering. It will create such serious problem, not only for our government and also for America as well.
Thank you, Sarkozy. The Quran burning by a Florida minister continued to stir protest in Afghanistan last week, as one activist explained to the Associated Press, even as officials suggested that insurgents were responsible for fomenting the initial attack on a UN headquarters that left seven dead. In Benghazi, Libya, the rebels we heard next railed against a fall-off in NATO-controlled air attacks on the forces of Muammar Gaddafi and at least two NATO bombings of rebel tanks and fighters.
In Syria, meanwhile, the largest protest yet brought the bloodiest repression. Tens of thousands rallied against the army in Cairo's Tahrir Square, and more than 100,000 converged on the capital of Yemen to demonstrate for and against the continued rule of President Ali Abdullah Saleh. To consider continuing unrest in the region and how it affects U.S. strategic interests and those of al-Qaeda, Iran, and other hostile parties, for Your Ears Only, we're joined again by Dr. David Kilcullen, the Australian military officer who was a top advisor to U.S. forces in Afghanistan and Iraq. He's now co-founder of Karas Associates, Consultants in Conflict Environments. And just out in paperback is his book, The Accidental Guerrilla, from Oxford University Press. Welcome back to our program.
Hey, nice to be here.
First, explain your concept of the accidental guerrilla and how it shapes or misshapes Western response to violence in places like Afghanistan and Iraq.
Accidental guerrilla is the term that I use to explain a syndrome whereby radical militant groups with a global agenda, which includes al-Qaeda, but not just al-Qaeda, infect and exploit local conflicts and disputes. They make safe havens, which they then use as a base to attack the West. We respond by coming into remote areas in force, and that causes a backlash from locals. Locals might not support the militants. We might not be targeting the locals, but we accidentally end up fighting each other anyway due to that backlash, and that usually takes the form of guerrilla warfare, hence the expression accidental guerrilla.
Now, would it be an example of the accidental guerrilla if Afghan insurgents turned the first Quran-burning protest into the fatal attack on that UN headquarters?
Yeah, not really. This is a fairly straightforward example here of religious militancy stirred up to some extent by local Islamic leaders, and that takes a particularly violent form because of local cultural norms in Afghanistan. There's not a lot of evidence of al-Qaeda involvement or any other global terrorist present.
Whatever the spark or instigation, some experts say the failure of local security forces to prevent that fatal UN attack show a long way before Afghanistan can assure its own stability, especially if America keeps to its timetable on withdrawal.
Yeah, I would agree with that in part, but we should also note that the Nepalese guards at the UN compound there were under orders not to defend themselves or defend the compound against civilians. So they allowed themselves to be overrun and subsequently killed as a result of those orders. I'd imagine the UN mission is probably reviewing its procedures as a result of that.
Switching to Libya, do you see lessons from the accidental guerrilla for how we deal with anti-Qaddafi forces that may very well include al-Qaeda or other extremists?
Well, the Libyan rebels, including their interim foreign minister, Mahmoud Jibril, have certainly made it extremely clear that they don't welcome outsiders, whether they be militants like al-Qaeda or Western military forces coming in on the ground. They rightly regard this as their own fight. And I think the main lesson here is that we should be extremely cautious about any kind of Western military presence on the ground in Libya. That's the sort of thing that can turn ugly very quickly.
Well, I know that your organization had some representatives in with the rebel forces, at least until recently. After heroic representation in the media, they are now reported as chaotic, incapable of forcing Gaddafi from office. What's your view on that and the wisdom of providing them with heavier weapons and the training that that would require?
Well, just to clarify, we don't do any military activity. We do development and governance work with civil communities. Our people who have been in Libya and the Libyans that we're talking to are telling us this is a genuine grassroots popular uprising. And as such, of course, it is messy and chaotic. I think the main challenge for the 31-member Transitional National Council right now is to demonstrate to the broader movement that it can actually govern, deliver services, and effectively represent people's wishes. The rebel military forces probably lack the ability to defeat Gaddafi, but his forces will also be prevented from wiping them out by NATO. So to me, this seems quite likely to end in a stalemate. Under those circumstances, I'd be very unwilling to arm the rebels unless an effective and recognized government is in place.
Even the U.S. military suffers tragedies of so-called friendly fire, but the refusal of NATO to apologize for bombing rebel tanks and change its procedures almost suggests it's sending a message that it takes its U.N. mandate very strictly to protect civilians, not to be the rebel air force. How do you read the situation and the larger NATO strategy as a stalemate solidifies?
Well, the UN mandate, UNSCA 1973, as it's called, is very tightly focused around the responsibility to protect civilians, meaning in this case non-combatants on all sides. So I think NATO is fairly tightly interpreting its role around preventing atrocities and protecting civilians. And NATO is, to some extent, acting in an apolitical way here. It's not taking a side on the dispute between Gaddafi and its people, but it's saying whatever your politics are, whatever your view on this dispute, these particular forms of behavior are unacceptable, and we're going to act kind of as an international referee.
Tanks are bad for children and all forms of human life, no matter what flag they fly.
Exactly.
Some say that siding against Gaddafi after he abandoned a nuclear program tells regimes in North Korea, Iran, maybe others, that nuclear capability is the key to staying in power. An unintended, unavoidable consequence?
Yeah, well, you're exactly right. I mean, the North Koreans actually came out last week and said explicitly that that's the lesson that they're drawing from events in Libya. But what are we going to do, not intervene to protect civilians? So I think you're right. To some extent, it is an unavoidable consequence here.
David Kilcullen is the Australian military officer who was a top advisor to U.S. forces in Afghanistan and Iraq, now co-founder of Karis Associates, consultants in conflict environments. His book, The Accidental Guerrilla, is just out in paperback. It's from Oxford University Press.
Another quote from the news. They say one thing now and another later. It's ridiculous. That was the mother of Chinese artist and social critic Ai Weiwei after Chinese authorities arrested him for alleged economic crime, part of a stepped-up crackdown to deter the kind of protest now rocking the Middle East.
Next, benefits from an epidemic. For your ears only. We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern with another quote from the news. No means yes. That was a chant by Yale fraternity pledges, according to a Title IX complaint from 16 Yale students and graduates that accuses the university of failing to eliminate a hostile sexual environment on campus. No means no, warned Vice President Biden as the Obama administration released new guidelines on the obligations of schools at all levels, better to prevent and respond to sexual assault on campus. Now this.
You're going to hear a lot of Medicare stuff. All we're talking about with Medicare is take the successes that we had with the prescription drug program. Take the model that works for us as members of Congress and federal employees and deliver health care through Medicare like that.
They essentially end Medicare as we know it. They don't reform it. They deform it.
Healthcare has long been a hot issue in the United States, driven by politics, passion, and often misinformation. The battle over Obama administration reforms began with images of gun-toting opponents at local town hall meetings. It carries on today in the courts and will continue as Congress considers the 2012 budget plan for Medicare proposed by Wisconsin's GOP Congressman Paul Ryan and derided by Maryland Democrat Chris Van Hollen.
And yet the Obamacare controversy is a tea party in the old sense of the term, compared with the venom and violence that surrounded the government-enforced vaccination campaign that eradicated killer smallpox epidemics at the turn of the century and left a lasting legacy for American public health. Brandeis history professor Michael Wilrich has documented that contentious antecedent to today's healthcare debate in a new book titled Pox, An American History from the Penguin Press. And he joins us now to talk about it for Your Ears Only. Welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me.
What led you to study the smallpox vaccination wars?
Well, I was interested in writing a history of civil liberties in the early 20th century. This is the period when the modern interventionist state was created in America. And all of my inquiries kept leading me right smack into smallpox, which was really a disease that was at the heart of the conflict between the citizens and their government in this period.
Remind us about the symptoms of smallpox and how deadly it was across the country at the turn of the century.
So smallpox was a truly horrific disease. It killed historically about a third of the people that became infected with it. Those who survived were left with terrible scars on their faces, often left blinded. The turn of the century epidemics were very interesting because a new, milder form of the virus was spreading very rapidly across the country at the same time as the older lethal form of the virus was killing people in major urban centers like New York, Boston, Philadelphia, Cleveland, and New Orleans. So you had a combination of a very dangerous disease out there with a milder form of the disease, and it made it very difficult for public health authorities to be able to convince people to get voluntarily vaccinated if they thought that they just ran a risk of catching the milder form of the disease.
How new was vaccination as a medical practice at that time? How did it compare with the vaccinations we know today?
So, first of all, vaccination against smallpox is really the oldest immunization technology. It in fact, was invented back in the 1790s, believe it or not, long before, full century before any other vaccinations came online. Vaccination for smallpox at the turn of the 20th century was very different from the vaccines we know today. It was not administered in a shot. In fact, a doctor would take hold of the individual's arm, scrape the skin with a sharp knife or needle, drawing a little bit of blood, and then would dab on a bit of vaccine matter. And the vaccine was essentially pus that had been harvested from a sore on the stomach of a sick calf.
Well, that sounds pretty unappealing. How extensive was the anti-vaccination movement at its height in this country, and how violent was it?
So there, in terms of an organized movement, there were anti-vaccination, anti-compulsory vaccination societies, as they called themselves, across the country. They published journals and books and pamphlets. They ran candidates for offices in local elections for the school boards, which often were the local bodies that issued vaccination orders. They sued in the courts. They tried to get new laws passed banning compulsory vaccination in the state houses. But there was also a much broader groundswell of opposition to compulsory vaccination from people who weren't part of any formal movement. But when vaccinators would come into their homes or their neighborhoods or their schools, they resisted. And when the vaccination was being carried out in a violent manner, they resisted with violence.
Well, what were some of the tough measures used by mayors, governors, the federal government when they decided that public health outweighed personal objections?
Well, in some of the most severe examples that I have in my book, cities like New York and Boston would establish these what they called virus squads, which were made up of vaccinators, doctors, and police officers. And they would go in the middle of the night to tenement districts and cheap lodging houses and break down doors if necessary and actually go into people's homes. And when people put up resistance, there was actually forcible vaccination.
There remains deep-seated suspicion about other forms of vaccination today and the misimpression that they're linked to autism, despite repeated studies to the contrary.
That's right. A lot of this can be traced back to a single study that was published in the British medical journal The Lancet back in 1998 by the lead author was a British medical researcher named Andrew Wakefield. And this study suggested that there might be a link between the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine and autism. In fact, this study was subsequently discredited. The Lancet itself retracted the story. Andrew Wakefield was struck from the medical record. He can no longer practice medicine. But somehow the medicine in Britain, somehow this association of childhood vaccines and childhood autism has remained very strong among members of the public. I think according to the most recent study, something like one-fifth of American parents believe that vaccines cause autism, and there's simply no evidence for that.
Brandeis History Professor Michael Rilrich. His new book on America's first vaccination war is Pox, an American History from the Penguin Press.
Next, a Japanese jazz pianist going for Baroque, for your ears only. We'll be right back. A coda for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
And I'm Eddie Robinson with this quote from the news. We will find each other. That was provocative TV talk show host Glenn Beck announcing he's leaving Fox News, but assuring his passionate audience that he'll use other platforms to reach them. Now this. From the track titled Tootie, on the new Verve CD, Baroque, by Japanese jazz pianist and composer Junko Onishi. With performances in New York this weekend, she completes her first coast-to-coast U.S. tour since the 1990s. And she joins us now to talk about her tour, the album, her career, and jazz generally for your ears only. Junko Onishi, welcome to our program.
Hi.
First, we must express our sympathy in the wake of multiple disasters still crippling Japan.
Oh, yes. It looks like it's really bad. We really don't have any idea when it's going to end, whole thing. But I'm sure we're going to, overcome.
And the show must go on, yeah. Yours and ours. So start telling us about how you first encountered jazz and what made you finally decide to make it your career.
When I was very young, like 17, something like that, I have an older brother, and he was a big fan of the fusion music at the time, like the Breaker Brothers and other kind of things. One day he got the album called Koten and the Monk. Then listened to it, and he didn't really understand. He just left it somewhere. Then one day I found it, then I listened to it. I was like, wow. I was really shocked. The tune was the Crepuscule with Neri. I wrote it by, I think that was a Monk tune. Then also the Monk tune, Monk's Mood. Yeah, that was the tune. So I was really shocked. That was the first chance that I was really into the jazz music.
How would you describe your own musical style as a pianist, interpreter, and a composer?
Okay, I think I'm pretty much an ordinal style. But I don't know. A lot of people say your music is kind of, or like your playing is kind of unique, that kind of thing. I don't really know.
Besides Coltrane and Thelonious Monk, who are your idols, your heroes, the people who've most influenced your own music?
Okay, Arthurum and Duke Ellington and Charlie Mingus, of course Charlie Parker, Bud Powell. Pretty much everyone. Then when I was in Berkeley, late 80s at the time, I was really into Kenny Kirkland.
That's not Berkeley, California, but the Merkley Music School in Boston.
That's right. Yeah.
Your music blossomed during the 90s, including a major appearance at the Village Vanguard here in New York at the renowned jazz festivals worldwide. Then you disappeared from live performance for some years. Can you say why and what you did instead?
I think I was kind of burned out. Yeah, because since I was 20, I started working as a side man for the Joe Henderson, like Betty Carter, so many people. Then I think I was kind of tired physically and mentally too. So one day I just felt like, I should stop. Let me think about my life, that kind of thing.
And what brought you back to live performing and recording?
Because during I was out from the scene, I really didn't listen to any music. Then I really didn't play the piano. I was really off from the music for a moment. Then I was into really the some kind of subculture or underground culture, the Japanese movie, the kind of thing that I never saw or touched before I came to USA. So I was they have so many good things on it. So I was like, wow. Then through the touching, that kind of things, I felt like, I kind of want to express something like that. Then, I wanted to be actually writing the comic, that kind of things. But, I found out I don't have any talent very quick. So what I could do was well, you know, the on playing the piano, I think. Then I kind of went back to the jazz scene in Japan because we have such a, I mean, a lot of little clubs and that kind of thing. So I just stopped by there. Then, hi, how are you? It's been a long time. You know, can I play a little? Then they're like, yeah, wow. Then, like that, I kind of gradually came back to the scene.
You provide inventive takes on Hoagy Carmichael's Stardust, UB Blake's Memories of You. What prompts you to choose a particular standard song like that? How important are the lyrics that are so familiar to us in shaping your interpretation, or is it just the music?
Okay, because I'm a Japanese, the English is not my the first English, first language, of course. So I was not really into the lyrics or that kind of things before when I was young. But one day, Betty Carter tell me how it's really important to know the lyrics and for the when you play the music, even just the instrumental thing. Then I started learning some lyrics when I really into that tune. But, you know, even now, the pretty melody or pretty harmony comes first to my ear.
Junko Onishi is an acclaimed Japanese jazz pianist and composer. Her latest CD is Baroque from Verve. Now the Tale of Tuti. And this has been For Your Ears Only.
Time for one more news quote. The policy really has to be food first. That was Hans Temmer, director of the Development Prospects Group of the World Bank, noting the diversion of crops for biofuel is raising the price of food and shrinking the supply, especially for the world's poorest people.
For Your Ears Only is online anytime at iTunes, News and Politics, or podcastbunker.com. But to continue, we need your tax-deductible donations or foundation grants. Please write to david.ears.only@gmail.com.
This broadcast was engineered by Chad Daly and Paul Roesk at Hargo Studios with intern Jordan Mazza. I'm Eddie Robbins.
I'm David Alpern. For Your Ears Only is a production of GateWave Incorporated, a 24/7 nonprofit radio reading service bringing vital information and enrichment to those who can't see.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on this show a year ago. I'm Jordan Mazza. This week last year, we considered Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens and the guessing game triggered by his decision to retire. From our April 11, 2010 Newsweek On Air broadcast, hosted by David and Isaac Davy Aronson.
I think the gridlock in the Senate might well produce a filibuster, which would tie up the Senate on a Supreme Court nominee. I think if a year passes, there's a much better chance we could come to a consensus. I think we need someone who will step into Justice Stevens' shoes, who will be very tough on the issues of executive power.
Whether or not you believe the Supreme Court follows election returns, it was clear last week that at least one justice was not listening to the pleas of elected leaders like Pennsylvania's Democratic Senator Arlen Specter on Fox News Sunday. Nearing 90 and already the longest-serving current judge on that top judicial bench, John Paul Stevens finally ended months of uncharacteristic agonizing to announce he will retire at the end of this term.
President Obama pledged quick nomination of his successor, though it was far from clear that he would follow Specter's advice either. Too liberal a choice risks raising stiff Republican opposition, already primed by a narrow defeat on health care reform. Too conservative a choice could undermine Democratic support, already troubled by Obama's continuation of Bush policies and the terror war and other issues. To understand why Stevens became a high court Hamlet, his legal legacy, and the political hornet's nest his decision stirred, we're joined again by Newsweek contributor Dahlia Lithwick. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Most Supreme Court justices prize a boldly decisive image. Remind us of the cushion that Sandra Day O'Connor kept in her office while serving on the court.
It speaks volumes. She had an embroidered pillow on her sofa, and it said, quote, maybe in error, but never in doubt.
Stevens' long internal debate was not much of a surprise after he hired only one law clerk for next year, and you've written that he seemed to be agonizing as much about the direction of the court as about his own future.
It's true. You need to know about John Paul Stevens. This is not a guy who bared his soul to the media. He really is representative of that generation of World War II veterans that is kind of dwindling away in public view, the one that keeps a stiff upper lip, you know, wears a jaunty bow tie, and keeps his feelings pretty close to the vest. And so in the last couple of weeks, as he's given not one but three interviews where he's very publicly debating, should I stay, should I go, I'm turning 90, I'm not sure, was very, very surprising. And I talked to some Supreme Court historians who confirmed that usually this is done with a bolt from the blue. You don't show the public that you're agonized. It started to look as though he was trying to tell us something about the direction of the Roberts Court, and in a very, very coded, subtle way to disclose that he had some real reservations about the directions of the court.
In assessing Stevens' legacy on the court, you used a word that became blacklisted after Obama used it to set up his first Supreme Court selection, empathy. Even Judge Sonia Sotomayor herself dismissed it. How does it fit a white Protestant Republican like Stevens?
Well, you know, I think it's such an important quality as we launch this next round of public bickering about diversity on the court. Let's agree the court is one of the least diverse bodies in the country. It doesn't look like America. It looks like a lot of Ivy-educated appeals court judges. And everybody takes one look at the court and says, you know what the court needs? It needs someone more like me. It needs more women. It needs more Asians. It needs more veterans. And all that is true. It's clear the court is not representative. The point that I wanted to make about Stevens was that you don't need to be a woman to get women's issues. You don't need to be a Guantanamo Bay detainee to understand what it's like to be stripped of the right to habeas corpus. And that Stevens, who looks to be paradigmatic of all that is out of touch about the court, you know, he's a waspy, wealthy, World War II 90-year-old guy, somehow I think was very representative of this quality of empathy. And I know that's a dirty word. You're not allowed to talk about it. But he really did, in case after case, insert himself into the other guy's shoes and say, you know, this strip search of this 13-year-old girl is not the same as sending a little boy to gym class, which was a big issue last year in a case, or the stopping an African-American simply because he ran away when he saw the cops. Doesn't mean that he's guilty. In some communities, you run away when you see the cops, whether or not you're guilty. He had this quality of being able to see the world from many different perspectives, from life experiences outside his own, and that maybe that's a quality we should be seeking instead of looking for a kind of check-the-box demographic in replacement.
Whatever political challenges Stevens' retirement now poses for President Obama, you argue that his public vacillating with hints to various reporters also caused problems for the White House.
Well, it did, because it created this kind of climate where everybody was anxious about whether or not there was going to be a confirmation hearing, and you had this target, you know, that was indefensible from the White House perspective. The White House couldn't say, well, here's who we're going to put up in his place, because he hadn't formally stepped down. So it gave a lot of the groups that are geared up, these machines of judicial advocacy groups, the ability to start whacking away at Obama and his potential judicial picks. You know, don't forget, we were hearing talk of filibuster even before Stevens had stepped down, much less a replacement had been named. So I think that the momentum that was going to the sort of fight against the Stevens replacement was not good for the White House. I think now that Stevens has stepped down, the White House is going to move very, very quickly to put up a nominee, just like they did last year, move very quickly to get the confirmation process in place, because the longer this drags out, the more you have this target that you cannot defend.
How do you assess the chances of the three front runners to succeed Stevens? Chicago Federal Appeals Court Judge Diane Wood, 59, Washington Appeals Court Judge Merrick Garland, 58, and Solicitor General Elena Kagan, 49, never a judge but former dean of Harvard Law School.
Well, one thing that I want to be very clear about is that even though this being talked about is the shortlist, the White House has never confirmed that this is the shortlist. This is a shortlist that is comprised of various leaks and uncorroborated reports. So I think the shortlist may be slightly different than this. But I will say I think that the clear message about this shortlist is that we are going to, these are the goalposts. This is somewhere within this range of nominees is going to tell us where Obama's stomach is for a fight. In other words, I think someone like Merrick Garland from the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals is not only confirmable, but already we've seen the right-wing judicial advocacy group saying, hey, we're fine with him. We'll confirm him tomorrow. Alternatively, someone like Kagan, it's going to be a bigger fight. She was the dean of Harvard Law School. She's the Solicitor General. She's taken some positions that might seem to be controversial on gay rights. So it could be a fight. I still think she's confirmable, but it's not going to be a cakewalk. And then Diane Wood, who really, I think, was with Sonia Sotomayor in the final running for David Souter's seat, I think that's a much bigger fight. I think she's got some really interesting abortion jurisprudence. She's got a long, long record to go through. It's just going to be whether or not Obama really feels like, I've got 59 votes in the Senate. I'm never going to have 59 votes again. I'm not going to try to be conciliatory. I'm going to push through a strong liberal voice. Or if he says, alternatively, after what I just went through with health reform, the last thing I want is another big bloodbath on my hands. I'm going to put up someone who's confirmable and save my powder for another day. So I don't even know that the question now is which of these nominees gets it. I think the question is really what kind of fight Obama wants to put up.
Newsweek contributor Dahlia Lithwick.
High Court Hamlet from our April 11, 2010 Newsweek on-air broadcast. President Obama did not wait long to choose the tougher road, nominating Elena Kagan, who was confirmed by a 63-37 Senate vote. Kagan has since recused herself from two dozen cases with which she had a connection as Solicitor General. She is under pressure to do so again if and when the health care reform law reaches the court, as is Associate Justice Clarence Thomas, whose wife has taken a prominent role in conservative opposition to the still controversial legislation. Last week, Kagan was in the minority on a ruling that upheld Arizona tax credits for donations to organizations that offer scholarships for private schools, including, but not exclusively, religious schools. I'm Jordan Mazza. We'll visit the archive again next week.